This is an interview with Dan McNamara and Jane Dillon. It's taking place in Cremorne. It's being conducted on behalf of the City of Sydney's History Program. The project is called the Shelter Oral History Project. My name is Margot Beasley and the date is the 15th of March 2011. So, perhaps each of you, if you wouldn't mind, just introducing yourselves and telling me where and when you were born.
Jane Dillon, 1954, New Zealand.
Daniel McNamara, 1954, in Western Australia.
Thanks. So we're here today to talk about the Autonomous House, which was something that you were both involved in very heavily in the mid-70s, and it was, I suppose, what we might think of as an early version of a sustainable house, which is usually the term that's applied now, but perhaps not so early. It was part of the times, but as you've told me before, Dan, it was actually part of a long tradition about houses that might be self-sustaining and in which people could live in an environmentally friendly and harmonious way.
Well, I would describe it as a small experimental house made of recycled materials, which was quite a big element of it, and using various technologies to provide energy for the residents. So it was a student project. And
Sydney University Architecture.
Sydney University Architecture School. And it was a project that was initiated by our tutor at the time, Colin James, who was also very interested in these things as well. And he was the one who organised the undergraduate study design program in which we were to do research and design the building and build it all in 1 year. And it was going to be filmed by Four Corners, the ABC TV program, and they were going to give us some money to help build it, which they never did.
The year was 1974?
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yeah.
So, Jane, what was your involvement?
I was a third year architecture student then, and we had Colin James was a really inspirational figure in, you know, in our education. The previous year the Nimbin Festival had been on, the Aquarius Festival, and Colin was one of the people deeply involved in getting that off the ground, and he just kind of inspired us that we could go there and we could save whales and save the world and build things out of bamboo or plastic or He made us think about architecture in a political sense. He was very entrepreneurial about getting things done that I think few other people would have been able to convince the university to give us this vacant plot of ground and convince us that it was a doable thing. That he had this kind of warmth and energy and drive and passion that was so different from a lot of the other people who were teaching us, that it wasn't really like a cult, but it was like, it's amazing that we could, you know, that he also trusted people to do things. You know, the second and third year students, he believed that we could go and do research that was going to be useful and sensible and that we could do anything.
So did you have the same experience, Dan?
Yes, very much so. Someone called Tone Wheeler, who was in the year above us, 2 years above
two
us,
years ago.
At the architecture faculty, he had, as part of his fourth year, done a trip to the United States and had done some research on the idea of building an autonomous house, which he produced as his fourth year thesis. And so we had that to draw on. And as I mentioned to you before, there was a group in England called the Street Farmers. I can't remember the name of the actual person, but he had set up a self-sustaining house with a greenhouse in inner city London, and grew his own food and used solar energy and that kind of thing, and was quite good at publicising it as well, and so it was known to us. And so they were probably the two main sources, I thought.
But the context was that there were all kinds of things happening everywhere. It was the time of the Whole Earth Catalogue, and there were festivals, hippie festivals all around the world, that people were looking at growing their own food, living a very minimal kind of life. Doing self-sufficiency was, you know, it was a bit like a settlers movement. There were also urban things going on with squatters and politics, and that it seemed like the Autonomous House, because it was in Darlington behind the university, was a kind of combination of bringing people back to live in the city. Colin was very interested in kind of revitalising the inner city, but doing it in a way that wasn't pushing out the poorer original people living there. That, you know, he was interested in looking at reusing factories instead of people buying up terrace houses and gentrifying them. And it was... And he also, and we to a certain extent stayed involved a bit with the movements that were happening around Nimbin, where people were building communal buildings and, you know, building their own houses and growing their own vegetables. And this seemed to be a way that we could be doing something that might have long-term use to people like that, who didn't necessarily have the skills that architecture students have. That the whole point was that any research that we did or any lessons that we learned would then be made available to other people.
I suppose we might make the observation that this is now, we're talking about 35 years ago, more, that there was a sense amongst young people anyway, the reason, you know, the hippie movements and so on, there was a sense that things were going very badly wrong in the world. And I suppose it was just post-Cold War, really. And I think part of what you're talking about, that kind of sense that things had to change, was very pervasive in food areas and the areas of dwellings. And there was all the Paul Ehrlich stuff was around too, about pollution and the end of the world is nigh, kind of stuff. Was very...
The Doomsday Book.
Very upper in people's minds, particularly young people.
I mean, it was happening everywhere. There was the Great Leap Forward in China, and there was, you know, the, was it 1968 in Paris with Danny the Red, and then there was lots of things happening in the United States as well. So it's part of the worldwide kind of convulsion that was going on at the time, I think.
Though the other thing was that there was also a real element of fun, that it wasn't all about doom, it was about making things better. You know, that we were so optimistic. And it was such good fun. We all lived in, you know, there were all these big share student houses around Glebe, and we were all living there and cooking lentils. And I mean, in fact, my kids say to me, oh, so there must have been lots of, you know, sex and drugs and stuff when you were being, you know, those hairy students. And I said, there was sex, but we were so poor that we didn't take very many drugs, and architecture students had to work very hard. So a lot of us had jobs as well as doing a big load of coursework. So in some ways I said, no, it was kind of oddly puritanical that, you know, we were eating vegetables, and if you grew them yourself, so much the better, and riding bicycles, and actually trying to minimise our footprint and our impression on the work. And it wasn't quite the hedonistic free-for-all that our kids imagined it was.
Early green moralism.
I know. Back now, I think we could have had a bit more fun, you know.
If we could just talk, I'd like to just talk a little bit briefly about precursors, if you were aware of them at the time, and then we'll move into the house itself, because they're not new ideas really, are they? They feel new to people when they're experiencing them, in the same way that I know people who are a lot younger than us now feel that a lot of the eco stuff that's happening now is, if they have a sense that that's new, that it hasn't happened before. And I think you talked a bit about, was it the Tolstoyan movements?
And
others in Europe about living more communally, treading lightly on the land.
The person that I was thinking of was, I think he was Count Peter Kropotkin. Who wrote a book about, I suppose it was sustainability, or I can't even remember. It's a very, very long time since I've read it. And there were lots of sources to draw on, I think. But I think that the kind of general thrust of it was, in a sense, anarchist, rather than anything. You know, it was just spontaneous. And as Jane said, it was really good fun. And so,
I think there's also links back to a lot of it. The thinking and the writing was coming out of America, and you know, obviously there were links back to Thoreau and, you know, living in the cabin by the pond, and you know, if you read some of the things, that the same kind of wacky New Age stuff that was floating around in the 60s and 70s was around then, with spiritualism and vegetarianism and feminism and nudism, and you know, you think, oh, they were doing this 100 years ago, and then, you know, I guess there was a bit of puritanical stuff and it disappeared, and then the baby boomers revived it.
Okay, so to the house. So you had a year to do it.
It was actually less than a year, and in fact one of the things that seemed very attractive about it was that Colin said that if we did it and we worked over the university break, then we probably wouldn't have to do any design in the last part of the year,
because we would have done it
because it was going to be finished, you know. So the first stage was research and development, and it was a group. It was seen very much as a group project, and it was
about how many people. The whole year, or
10 or 12?
10 or 12.
Probably. Yeah.
And it was a combination of second and third year students. We were the third year students, so we were much more in control. And the second year students were just, I don't know, slaves. No, they weren't. But we had to think about what we needed to know. You know, so it was a really interesting project that we needed to find out about materials, we needed to find out about energy, we needed to find out about food, we needed to find out about council planning. And so none of us had ever done anything like that before. There were a few people who picked up a hammer, but most of us hadn't.
Most of you are more familiar with drawing things and plans rather than actually making them.
Probably not even that, because at that stage the architecture school was quite anarchic. That there had been, when we were in first year in 1972, there'd been a strike where, initiated by students older than us who were reacting to the very rigid course structure where everything was compulsory and there wasn't freedom to move. And so there was a strike and a negotiated settlement where the course, there were certain compulsory things, but the course was thrown open, and if you could justify doing anything, learning Italian or making leather bags or doing a horticulture course, and could justify how it would link into the design course, then you're free to do anything. And in second year, a lot of us went to the Nimbin Festival, and our design work was actually digging holes for the latrines and building structures out of plastic and hanging out by the edge of the creek. So by the time we got to third year, we didn't necessarily know all that much about design or architecture. Well, this is me. Other people knew things, but I kind of knew how to make wholemeal bread. And
if we could just clarify about the strike, it wasn't just in your department, was it?
It was just architecture.
Oh, there was just an architecture one, because there was another big issue. It's
there were
political economy. But
and
this was separate to that.
Yeah, this was.
Right.
And there was a very tolerant dean of architecture, Peter Johnson, and he was, you know, he was keen to keep his students happy and have it an interesting course, and you know, so it was a kind of fun strike, and the outcomes seemed to be good for us at the time. The course now has moved very much back to more traditional architecture and teaching, because I think the result of it was at the end lots of people were kind of fairly unemployable because they didn't know anything about architecture.
You've both managed to go on to careers in architecture, but we won't talk about that just yet. So back to the house, how did it all start? Like, how did you just go out in gangs and get lots of bottles from places, or what did you actually physically do to get the house going?
Well, one of the most difficult things was coming up with the design with a group of people who were completely inexperienced.
How to make sure it wasn't a camel.
And that was a very difficult process, and we had to submit the plans to council, and in the documents you'll see that the drawings that we submitted to council, which are perhaps not that untypical of drawings that were submitted to council at the time, but they are very, very simple. And we had to get approval from council. And while we were doing that, we had to get permission to use the site from the university, which proved to be quite difficult. And also, we had no materials either. So we had to work out how to get our materials, which meant actually going around to places where demolition was occurring, and we got bricks and roofing materials, corrugated iron. The wall at the front of the house, which was part of a system called a Trom-Michel wall, which had a greenhouse in front of it, and we made this wall out of beer bottles filled with water, and the idea was that the sun's heat was trapped in the greenhouse, which was also used to grow food, and the heat would be absorbed into the water in the bottles, and at night time it would re-radiate back into the house as to keep us warm, and in the daytime there was some kind of system of venting which allowed a flow of air to supposedly cool the house as well. But we're only talking about a structure that was, I think, 6 metres by 10 metres in size, so it's probably smaller than this room, I think.
But that was the original plan?
Well, that's what was built.
That's what was built.
But traditionally a Trom-Michel wall was made of heavy masonry so that you had a heat bank, but because we didn't have money or skill to make a heavy masonry wall, I don't know whose idea the bottles were. Really good idea, but it meant to get them, we used to go round the back streets of Glebe and Darlinghurst collecting beer bottles. In those days, people tended to drink 750ml bottles. So
long necks, as they're called.
Long necks, yes. Mm.
And I rang up Crown Corning and got them to donate a whole lot of bottle tops, and we had a little system going that we'd fill them and cap them. And
we had to go around at night time.
Yeah.
Collecting bottles from the backs of pubs and things like that.
Outside people's houses.
And collect them all, and I think we washed them, and then we had this kind of set up. You know, someone had a bottling, a capping, sort of machine.
But we did, because we didn't have any money. We just rang up suppliers and said, "We're architecture students and we're doing this project, and would you like to donate?" You know. Forticon, which is waterproofing material that had to go under the bricks so that the water didn't come up, or would you like to, we needed nails, and you couldn't, there were lots of things that you could scavenge, but fasteners you couldn't. So it was surprising how many manufacturers came to the party, and you know, kind of, well, we'll give you a box of nails. Or
Jane was very good. Jane was the best at doing that kind of thing, I think.
That's a job.
So that was that, did you have designated tasks? Was it your job to ring up manufacturers?
Yeah. I think I volunteered to do it once, and then it seemed to work, and so it was quite anarchic. There wasn't really a structure. The idea was that there would be certain times of the day when everyone had to commit to a certain number of hours a week on the project, but when it obviously wasn't moving very fast, we started getting up earlier and working later, and some people, like Dan, put in immense, and Michael, and you know, various other people, put in huge amounts of work that was disproportionate to what other people were doing, which seemed kind of fine at the time, until at the end of the project, because it was a formal part of our education, we had to be marked on it. And we'd always thought, because it was a group, we would all just have a group mark, and we were only interested in pass or fail. and we thought it was so good that none of us could fail. But the university said no, they had a structure and they had to have distinctions and high distinctions. And so it was thrown back to us that the group had to decide how to grade everyone within the group. And at this point it was, do you remember, we all sat around in a circle and we were told that, you know, there had to be, you know, a couple of distinctions and passes and credits and, you know, the bell curve. And so it turned to this thing and people say, oh, well, I think X should get this mark. And then someone said, what about me? And we say, you're never here, you didn't get up. How many times have we taken us? So what had been this, you know, wonderful, optimistic, caring, sharing thing, you know, kind of turned into a bit of a debacle towards the end of it because of the university structures.
Now, did either of you actually live in the house?
Yes, I did.
You did?
Yes.
So how long did you live in it?
I lived in it for 2 years, for the last 2 years of my second degree in architecture. And there were a number of other people who lived in it as well for that period. And there were also people who just lived there for, you know, a shorter period of time.
And can you just tell me a bit about the experience of living there?
Day-to-day life? It was actually a great place to live because it was right next to the architecture faculty. And
it was free.
The rent was great because it was free. And as part of one of my courses, I designed and built a novel form of solar water heater. And so we had solar hot showers when the conditions were right. We also had a wind generator, which had been donated by a firm called Quirks, I think. A small wind generator with a 6 foot, 1.8 meter diameter blade. And it generated electricity, which was stored in 2 12-volt batteries. And so when there was good winds in, usually over the last part of the year and in September to sort of February, we used to get a fair amount of electricity in our batteries and enough to run a little caravan fridge and little 12-volt fluorescent lights, which were also for caravans and camping and that kind of thing. But in quite a large part of the year when there was no wind at all, we used to take the batteries up to the tin sheds and charge them. Tin sheds being the art workshops.
Artist space on
just over the road.
City road, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we shared the autonomous house was on Alma Street in Darlington, and between Alma Street and City Road were the architecture faculty and the art workshops just near the Wentworth building, which was the student union.
Yeah.
So with those, you know, a little bit of electricity and a little bit of hot water, and we also had a garden, which was maintained by one of the residents who did a very good job growing vegetables in a garden that had been laid out in a spiral by one of the people at the art workshops.
A spiral being a desirable...
I think so. I think that was the
vegetable design.
That was the implication.
A mandala of vegetables.
That's right. And so there was quite a nice community of people. We had, I think, at the most we had 4 people living in the house, and there were also some people living at the workshops as well, and so there was quite an exchange and. Between the different groups, and we would be up there doing our art projects and they'd be down perhaps getting some things from the garden or something like that. But being located quite close to the architecture factory, it meant that we were a local curiosity for people who were visiting. And so quite a lot of people used to go to the architecture school and give lectures in the lunchtime forums. And quite often they would come down and have lunch at our house with us. And so we had also a very kind of interesting and stimulating time with those people as well. Plus, members of the public would come and visit And we received letters from all over the world as well. So there was a lot of interest at the time in what we were doing. And it was, so it was a very kind of fertile and stimulating environment to live in, actually.
But it was also a focus for things like the alternative technology fairs.
That's
and
right, yeah.
A series of lectures. And, you know, so there would be times when all these people would come and set up stalls that would be looking at different aspects, keyline farming or, you know, methane digesters. I mean, that was one thing that didn't get approval from the city council. The idea had been to have a methane digester to take the sewerage, which would generate gas that would be used for cooking, and somehow the city council wouldn't come at that. I think especially handcrafted by students out of leftover materials, it didn't sound incredibly reliable.
So we used to use the facilities at the architecture school and the tin sheds, and also at the Sydney University Union as well. I mean, there were lots of compromises.
Yeah, so I was going to say, so the house wasn't entirely autonomous.
Oh, by no means.
Could not have been, I suppose.
No. Mm.
But it was a good go. So to what, I mean, can you talk about the degrees to which it was autonomous? I suppose it's a contradiction in terms to say degrees of autonomy, but
had a rainwater tank. Did you get?
Yes,
all the water.
Yeah, all the water used to come from the rainwater tank, which we had to pump up by hand into a header tank. Then we had a bit of electricity. I mean, we probably, you know, it was maybe 40% of our needs.
But that's because it was very small. It was probably only about 60 square metres or
what?
Yeah, yeah. So it didn't ever get bigger than that 60 square metres.
No,
four people.
And so four people were living there. If one person had lived there, it probably would have been autonomous in electricity as well. It's just...
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, with more people, you need more things.
Mm. So what were the sleeping arrangements? Were they four single people or couples or...?
Generally single people. I think occasionally there were couples. But the design of the house, it was really just one large room with a sort of a kitchen, a very small kitchen at one end, and a bathroom, which Jane and I designed, which was made out of beer bottles in the shape of a curve, which was open to the air. And that was it. The kitchen and that bathroom were at the western end. And on the eastern end, there was a very small veranda with doors on swivels to get the, almost like two vertical louvers to get the breezes into the house. The northern wall was made out of these beer bottles filled with water in two sort of curved panels. And they were a very beautiful wall, and every visitor would remark on it because the beer bottles were... mostly the dark brown ones. I mean, I think there was the odd green one or clear one, but they were mostly the amber ones, and they were full of water, and when the sun shone on them, it was this beautiful warm glow. So they were very interesting to look at as well. And then above that single space, which was a living area, which also had three workspaces
with drawing boards
in them, because we had to do our university work. And then we had a tiny little wood stove, a fuel stove, that Colin James had lent us in the middle, which sometimes we would cook over in wintertime, and we used that, and that would heat up the whole house. And then over this larger space there were wooden roof trusses, which were donated to us by a building company, and these were spaced at about 2 meter intervals, I think. And so in each of the spaces in between these roof trusses, we built lofts, and we climbed up to the lofts using ladders, we had our own beds up there with small windows in the roof. And so it was very much like a big cubby house.
But you had your piano there too, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, we had a piano there. We had everything. I mean, we had a letterbox at the front gate, which was made in the shape of the head of one of our lecturers.
There was a lot of
letters. Yeah, yeah, there was a lot of making of things that were sort of useful art objects, I suppose.
Mm.
As I say, there was this very strong connection with the art workshops, and in fact, one of the people who lived in the house, he used to teach leatherwork at the art workshops, and so we were all doing leatherwork at one stage, and so we'd be making things, and also making screen prints. There was a lot of poster making going on as well, and also we had a lot of friends who would sort of come and visit and be doing their screen prints or their artwork, and then come down and we'd just all sort of sit around and talk and do things. So it was a very happy kind of place to be, actually.
One of the best things was when Michael White, now Mardo Vijaya, had been, who's now a really highly regarded landscape designer in Bali, but at that stage he was an architecture student who'd spent time in Bali.
I'm sorry, what was his name?
Michael White, or now Mardo
Vijaya? Michael White.
And he has another name as well,
or
Mardo
Vijaya.
Oh,
I see. Bali. He lives in Bali. But
okay.
He came back from Bali all inspired and decided that he would set up a little warung. So he got a bicycle shop to make him one, and he would be
was that a betcha? Is that what they're called? The thing that you ride around.
And sell food off. And so he would cook this delicious food, but sometimes he would end up at the autonomous house and everyone would sit outside in the garden.
Well, no, he built this restaurant. Remember that?
Oh, yes.
Called the Warung Majura 2. And he told, as part of his assessment, he was going to, for Asian art and architecture, probably, for a course, he was going to set up this restaurant. And as part of his contribution to the whole thing, he was going to feed the workers from his restaurant. And he said, I'm going to do it all in one day. And so I got a pile of bamboo and this kind of materials like palm fronds and things like that. And he, in one day, erected this small structure, which must have been about 2.4 metres by 2.4 metres, which had a counter along one side, and I think it had some plastic over the roof or whatever. And he used to do the cooking for us, and we would have lunch of nasi goreng and
lots of krupuk.
Yeah, these kind of bean sprouts. I remember a lot of them. And then at night time, in summer, he used to run it as a restaurant, and
as a going concern.
Yes, and so I remember. No, perhaps I shouldn't say, but people, from the city, theatre directors and other notables were having dinner at the Warung Majura 2, being served food by Michael White, whilst he was, and after dinner he would put on a shadow puppet play.
And this was all in the immediate vicinity of the house.
And he kept ducks. Yes, there was.
And
I mean,
he kept ducks.
He kept ducks. And it was about, 5 metres away from the house. It was in the same compound. And so this was happening. I don't think the city council knew much, but I doubt
that. No,
once
there was a goat there too.
Oh, that's right.
Yes, tell me about the goat.
Well, whose goat was it? I can't remember whose goat was it, but it stayed for a while, and then all the engineering students complained that they couldn't study on their exams because the goat was bleating outside the window. So, did Michael cook it?
I don't know. No, I don't think so.
So there weren't any other animals there apart from the goat and the...
Were there chooks?
I don't remember chooks. I mean, nothing was organised. I mean, we were students and we didn't like responsibilities, so there was It's nothing like a pen with chooks that were being looked after. These were simply, you know, animals that somehow had some kind of, you know, token value or something like
and
that.
Goats, I suppose, are good at looking after themselves.
Well, that's right. The goat, we got a goat so we wouldn't have to cut the grass. And that was the idea. And whether it was successful or not, I don't know.
Mm. And what about the social relationships within the house? If there were four of you there at one time, I suppose that was a shifting population, was it?
Well, it was fairly stable. And we all got on very well, actually. It was remarkable.
Because that was part of the times too, wasn't it? The idea that you didn't have to live in what I suppose is would then have been called bourgeois architecture, that is a private house with private bedrooms where people can be separated away from each other, genders separated and so on. Like that was sort of the bourgeois ideal of the late 19th century, that's a proper house in inverted commas. But part of the idea about the times, about communal living and a whole lot of other things, is that those things were not really necessary, that this was an imposed notion of sort of social respectability, I suppose.
Mm. Well, yeah. I mean, the house was kind of, it was designed around the idea of really communal space and private space. And so there was communal space, which was the open area, and then there was private space in each of the lofts. There was just no acoustic privacy, that's all.
Mm.
And it was a very small space. So I think that, you know, for students, it was fine.
It had never been... I mean, when we started building it, the permission from the university was only to leave it there for a few months, and it was always seen as a kind of short-term thing, that it would get built, it would be admired, and then it would be taken down. But then people started living in it, and its life extended over several over a lot longer.
1974 to 1978, yeah.
Yeah, so it was if it had been seen as a long term thing and if there'd been more resources, it might have been bigger and there might have been a bit more private space, but it was, you know, it was never really thought that anyone would seriously live in it.
Well, that's another element, isn't it?
Mm. Well, also one of the sort of design considerations that was put most strongly to us was that it should be as minimal as possible, and that we were actually exploring the minimum amount of space that people could use. And I think that it worked because, first of all, we were young students, and secondly, we spent a lot of time outside as well. You know, we were off doing things, so we weren't actually stuck inside, you know. There was a garden, we had bicycles, that's how we used to get around the place. We were off doing our studies and that kind of thing. So we didn't really have that kind of pressure that you might have living long term with a group of people in a house like that.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the things that Colin James was pushing, that he'd spent time in China before he was teaching us, and he would turn up in his Mao hat, but he kept saying in China, people live in tiny spaces, you know, whole families live in these small rooms. So part of the research we were doing was, you know, just kind of looking at what kind of footprint people have, what size people's houses were, and, you know, we're all shocked at, you know, how grossly we were.
Like our parents' houses.
Our parents' houses, mind you. You know, we had five kids in a three-bedroom house, and, you know, the boys were on the back veranda. It was, you know, but compared to today's monoliths, and, you know, we were over-endowed.
Mm-hmm.
But we did. We tried to seriously do a lot of research. That, I mean, one of the things that I was looking at was about vegetables, and it was what size of a vegetable garden did you need to be self-sufficient in food? And I thought, oh, this will be easy. I think I put my hand up for that one because it seemed easy. But in fact, it became very complicated because you had to think how many people there were, how much they'd eat over time, what they needed for a balance, what you could do seasonally, how you could rotate all the crops. And this is what we found about each element that we looked at, that it seemed simple, but it was complex, and they all tied into each other. So it was, I mean, it was an amazing project to be involved with.
Mm.
I think what you're saying there is that it's what young people have to do is that they have to be involved in the world to find out how complicated it is, that perhaps some of the older
ways of doing things, that there's a strong reason for them, like farming and so on, seasonality and availability and crop failure and any number of other things. You can imagine when you're 19 or 20 that it's all you have to do is put the broccoli in the ground and it will grow.
That's right.
It's not really that
then
easy.
The cosmos kind of, you know, and then but there was also the organic movement and the biodynamic movement, and then Bill Mollison.
Oh yeah.
You know, because it was.
Yeah, he turned up after. Just when he was doing
permaculture.
He was the permaculture man.
David Holmgren actually was the permaculture.
Oh,
person.
Sorry.
And then.
So Bill Mollison.
Well, he then became a guru of permaculture as well, but. But some of that was, you know, they would turn up at the fairs and have their stall. So there are a whole lot of wider things that were linking in.
Remember Joan Bradley,
Weeding the Bush.
Yeah, she and her sister, I can't remember her sister's name, they were the two people who started Bush Regeneration. And
the Bradley sisters.
And Jane and I went along to
Parowee Park
where they were working to talk to them and to get them to come along and give a talk at one of the Autonomous House fairs, which they did, and they came along and described their work to interested people, and that's now a worldwide movement. So it was there at the beginning.
It must have been a fantastic time.
It was.
Yeah, a wonderful thing to be involved with.
I think there was something very exciting about being an architecture student at that time, because I think that we had friends who were studying in other parts of the university who were generally reporting very dreary experiences with essays and things like that.
Old-fashioned university work.
All that kind of hard stuff. And while we were, you know, able to experiment a lot with, particularly with structures and things like that, and it was a really good way to get that kind of, I suppose, basic understanding of a wide range of things. And one thing that we were really fortunate for was that we had a very sort of benign and generally sympathetic academic staff in the architecture faculty, and they would say things like, well, this isn't very, you know, this isn't a, you're not doing proper research here, you know, you should be sort of more rigorous about it, and you should be making, you know, a statement to the public about what you've learnt and this kind of thing. And being, I suppose, naive young people, we ignored all of that kind of advice. But at the same time, they supported us and they tolerated us and let us continue. And they also could see the benefit to us as students, just being involved in the complexity of it all, because it's a very, very complex thing. And I think that, you know, I'm certainly very grateful for that sort of support, which is, as I say, sort of benign amusement, really, but, you know, valuable to us, and knowing that we were sort of really just very young students. Really.
But there were great facilities. There was a wonderful workshop with welders and bandsaws. You know, that they would stand there as we go, keep your hand. But one of my projects, I think it was, you know, my third year design project, I made, I used a welder to make a portable barbecue out of a 44-gallon drum, and it had slide-out things and had wheels and had handles, and it was fantastic. So it was a terrible shock to me when I decided to go back and finish architecture a few years later that I got to fifth year and I realised that I, apart from the Autonomous House, I'd never designed a building. You could kind of skirt around doing all these bizarre projects and getting credit for them and, you know, kind of avoid real thought about what architecture was. But one of the things that was interesting about the course when we were doing it then is it was a feeling, you know, there was, Alvin Toffler, and, you know, there are all kinds of people, future shock, saying we don't know what the future is going to be, and so what we have to teach you is to be flexible and adaptable and be able to think on your feet and do things. So there was a big push to move away a bit from the very technical skills of architecture and to bring in people like Liz Fell and Wendy Bacon, who were teaching us sociology and anthropology, and we were reading Levi-Strauss and looking at, there was, Amos Rappaport, who was an American kind of anthropologist but architect as well. And the big emphasis was on people. You know, it wasn't on the buildings, it was about thinking about how people related to that space, and that the more we understood about people and their concerns and desires and other things, the more flexible and the better our buildings would be, because they'd be responding to that kind of need.
Mm. And at that time, I think one of the kind of major thrusts of architectural style at that time was brutalism, which was concrete and high-rise concrete buildings, and I think a lot of it was a reaction to that kind of thing. I mean, the Autonomous House was, I suppose, part of that reaction.
Why did it end after 4 years? What happened?
The way that it ended was that it was getting more and more difficult to convince the university year by year that we deserved to stay there. And also there was a feeling amongst the residents that it was coming to the end of its natural life. It wasn't a particularly durable structure, and we thought that it would be better just to have it there for a period of time, but then for it to be gone, rather than dying a lingering death by being abandoned and or taken up or not taken up by other students. And so we just thought that, well, you know, the time's up. There's been a lot of interest, it's better to go gracefully.
So it was dismantled.
It was, dismantled. Some bits and pieces were recycled. The university bulldozed parts of it, to clear it up and clear the debris off the site. And I think that is it now built on that site?
It had greenhouses last time.
It was good.
But I haven't looked for a while.
No, I haven't been there for a long time. But it is part of the university. I think it might be some open space.
I thought it belonged to the agriculture people had, and they were growing.
There was a greenhouse at the end.
But I also thought they were growing different types of grass at one stage, and it was a rare bit of open space. And I mean, I'm sure they'll fill it up with something. That every other piece of Darlington is now full of university buildings.
Mm.
Was there any kind of event marking the end of the house?
No. No, there wasn't. There had been events during its life with the technology fairs, but no, it was unheralded.
So people weren't particularly sentimental about it once the time had come.
No, not really.
No one was throwing themselves in front of the bulldozers.
No,
well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because it's easy retrospectively to think people might be terribly emotional about something like that, but in fact to say people were reasonably practical about it.
Yeah, very much so, I think. I mean, it was something. I mean, by that time, of course, we were late in our courses. When I say late, we were in the upper years of our courses, and there were new students coming through who weren't sort of that wrapped in the idea of what these old students were doing and weren't that interested in it. And so, without continuing interest, and enthusiasm, it's something that, you know, would probably suffer and decline. And so we thought, oh, well, we'll finish now.
You mentioned to me at another time, Dan, that the house could not be built now. Can you tell me a bit about how things have changed? I think you mentioned occupational health and safety particularly, but also all kinds of other regulations, because architects are functioning in a much more regulated environment. So could you tell me a bit about that?
Well, you can see it most clearly when you look at the drawings that we submitted to council, and they were hand-drawn for A4 sheets. Very, very simple drawings. And council, I think they did approve it in the end, perhaps with reservations. But if you look at the amount of documentation that's required today to do anything in the built environment, it's enormous. There's an enormous amount of regulation that's involved in doing any kind of construction. And I think that you can see that we had very, very simple systems, solar systems and wind energy systems on the house at that time. And as I said, it was built in a fairly anarchic kind of environment, whereas these days, those kind of things they're the subject of an enormous amount of regulation and complexity that I don't think it would be possible for students to repeat that kind of thing these days. And there was an attempt several years ago, I'm not sure how many years ago, for students to build a similar kind of dwelling out of, I think it was out of cardboard.
That was Adriano's.
Yes, and they were going to build it in a on a site that I think maybe Waverley Council was going to donate to them or whatever. And they actually designed some of their structures, but they couldn't get past the costs involved, and I'm not sure whether the site came through or not. So they did a lot of work, but they weren't able to pull off actually getting something built on the ground.
And it's rather difficult to imagine any space being available within Sydney University now for a project like that. It's so crowded, the campus itself. Space within universities has become so valuable. I think you were saying...
Oh, yes, quite likely, yes.
Mm. I mean, okay. Mm.
But it wouldn't. But the other thing that the house wouldn't comply with at all is the Building Code of Australia. That now there's so many rules that regulate waterproofing in wet areas, and you know the shape of the ladders that you have to comply with things. That I can't even remember whether council ever came to inspect it. Did they?
I don't think so.
If they did, obviously it was okay because it went on standing.
Well, the thing is that during the life of it, there was a great deal of very, very favourable publicity. And it was in all of the newspapers, and it was on TV and on the radio, and it was a focus for interest for people at that time. And so that reflected quite well on the university and also on the city council as well. They thought it's not exactly our style, but we don't seem to be getting criticised for it. So, you know, let's just say that this is a student experiment and leave it at that, you know. And they reflected in, basked in their reflected glory.
Mm. Now, what about your own careers in architecture subsequently? Can you say that the things that you learned then have informed your practice in the intervening years?
Very much so, I think. But, I mean, now most architects will say they're interested in environmental sustainability and energy efficiency, but we kind of got off very early thinking about where the sun came from, where the winds came from, particularly in that house because it was so kind of open to the elements. it was, you know, the indoor-outdoor experience that everyone talks about now, and it was open plan. So a whole lot of ideas that people have now embraced in my suburban houses were demonstrated in the house itself. But also, I think in my own architectural career, it was the politics of it that kind of interested me as well, in trying to make things accessible to people who didn't necessarily have a lot of money to do it. That one of the spin-offs from it that was the book Low Cost Country Home Building, mm-hmm. that again Colin James initiated, and various students, a lot of whom had been involved in the Autonomous House, did research to put together a book that would help the people who were the new settlers up around Nimbin and Mullumbimby. And I think from a, you know, that because it was kind of mingled with the inner city left in a whole lot of different ways, that different people were involved in different things. I worked in a women's refuge, and we were interested, because of where it was very close to the block, and Colin James was very involved in Indigenous issues.
So the block, meaning the block in Redfern, which is a very well-known Indigenous area, particularly for Indigenous housing.
Yes. Mm. So there were kind of fringe things that we're involved with. And in my own career, I then became very involved in Indigenous architecture and spent 8 years in Alice Springs. But a lot of it came from that time, and came, in my case certainly, from Colin, and he's pushing us to do things that were of benefit to other people.
How about you, Dan?
Well, I suppose as a result of designing and building that house, I went off with other people who had worked on it, and we spent our years after graduation working as builders, designing and building, in lots of different locations, which was very interesting for us. And we worked on the Low Cost Country Home Building program with Colin James, and I think that the experience of living there, and also seeing the benefits and the limitations of the way that we did live, has really informed, you know, quite a lot of my work generally, and enabled me to take things with a grain of salt, or at least to be able to sort of realise that there are limitations and compromises that are involved in these things all the time, and that so much of it is overpromised these days. And really, that when you do look at fairly carefully at the kind of the way that you had to live in that sort of circumstance, I can see that we were enormously privileged and supported by the society, just being students, and having that opportunity of the free time and our own labour to do things, and that's in short supply these days. And it almost seems like a freak of that time, that was the case.
And I think there may have been no university fees at that time as well. Just as another
right,
issue,
yes.
that there was a sense, if you weren't paying fees at university, it was added to the freedom.
Mm.
I think we were the last year when the fees were there, but we had Commonwealth scholarships, so we didn't have to pay fees. But then subsequent years, it came in. And I was actually thinking that it happened partly because of the freedoms of the Whitlam years. That I was thinking that even if someone had tried to get that project up later in the 70s, it probably wouldn't have happened.
Just two things I wanted to still talk about. One is, it'll seem like a silly question, but what did your parents all think of the Autonomous House? Did they have a view on what you were doing? Were they enthusiastic? Or you were still very young then, not long left home.
Mm.
And I just wondered if there was any kind of, even a sense of parental approval or disapproval.
My mother was really interested. I mean, when we first started architecture, one of the very first things they did with us in the first year was take us up to a scout camp up near Newcastle, And before that, they had a meeting where they invited everyone's parents to come. Mm. And basically they said, hands off your children, they're ours now. And they're going to do things you don't approve of, but they're going to have a really good time. And so all these kind of middle-class parents go, oh, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? And it was a bit... my mother was a bit affronted by that. I think she was sort of, you know, I've carefully brought up this girl and sent her to a good school and she knows how to wear white gloves and look what's going to happen to her. But she was then really fascinated by... And I think we just told them what we were doing. You know, we just said... You know, I said, I'm hitching up to Nimbin or I'm doing this or I'm leaving home and I'm going to live in this house with all these people you don't know. And I think they realised there was nothing they could do.
There was also, I think at that time, much less parental involvement anyway, which is another historical change, that once your children had left home, I think there was a sense that it was almost none of your business what they did.
Mm.
But I was just wondering if the whole ideology of the period must have been fairly challenging for the preceding generation, and I just wondered whether there was any... Well, interest, approval,
yeah,
disapproval.
No, there was interest from my family. I can't remember it exactly, but I think my mother visited the house. And they were generally interested in what I was doing. Because it was so novel, I think. And also, there wasn't anything else happening like it at all. So it's not as if you could even see it as a threat to your values or lifestyle or anything like that. It was more like, this is what these kids are doing. At least they're not doing, at least they're not in the Bader Meinhof gang or something like that.
No, I must say when I made certain decisions which might have been shocking to my parents, I didn't even contemplate what it might mean to them. I think when you're young and impetuous,
and you don't. Mm.
You just do what you do.
Mm.
Mm.
I mean, there were certain things, like when I was 19 and moved in with my boyfriend, where I thought, it's possible my father might say, never darken my doorstep again, but, oh, well.
That's a risk you're prepared to take.
Oh, absolutely.
The other thing I'd like to talk a bit about, if you don't mind, is what is coming through is how important a teacher Cole James was. And I wonder if you could say any of this might have happened if he hadn't been there.
I don't think it would have. I think that when things do happen, they happen because someone leads them, basically. And that leadership, it was taken by Colin, and he, with the support of Peter Johnson, the Dean of the Architecture Faculty, and with our enthusiastic work on it, that's how it really happened. I mean, there were lots and lots of people involved in that, but I don't think it would have happened at all if Colin hadn't kind of seized the moment, really.
Yeah, he had the idea and he then had to convince the hierarchy within the architecture department that it was a worthwhile course. But equally, he could have put the course up and everyone could have said, what? What are you thinking about?
Yeah.
You know, why are we going to spend time doing that when we could be doing something else? And in fact, most students didn't do it. There were about probably all up 150 students in first and second year, and out of that, only 10 or 12 did it. And I don't know whether that was lack of enthusiasm on everyone else's part or whether the project was limited.
I guess it looked to be quite vague and uncertain as to what the outcome might be. And so the more hard-headed students would have thought, it's probably I should do something that's going to be more useful to me in getting a job or something like that when I do graduate, or in my fourth year, which was the year that we had where we could work or travel. So I think that it was just one of a number of options, and the group of us who chose to do it had the experience.
And I guess had the interest in the first place to, and perhaps gravitated towards Cole James.
Well, a lot of us had been involved with Cole the previous year with the Nimbin Festival festivities. And I think there were a group of us who were interested in politics and social justice and other things, which Cole was pushing, you know, very much as one of the important roles that architecture should be taking. That there were a number of other movements that were happening, that architects were getting involved with, you know, helping the poor in the barrios and other things that he kept holding up as examples to us. I think he felt we should take the torch and go out and enlighten the world. And he was just he was great to work with, because he was a kind of big picture man, not a details man, and so it left us kind of free to scurry about and do what we felt was important. But he'd keep, you know, just herd us back onto the path. And in the end, when we had to do the And the other thing at the end of the project is we had the house and we'd done the self-assessment, and, you know, friendships had been wrenched apart through the low grading that people got. The university then said, we're not going to accept this, that we can't accept some kind of group assessment, and unless you all hand in individual designs and drawings of an autonomous house that you've designed yourself, you will fail. And by this stage, the year was almost over. I was planning to go to India and Africa and working, you know, full-time as a waitress, and they said to us, you've got to do these drawings. So we all did some drawings and handed them in, and then the university graded them. We could say, why do we need drawings? We've got the house, you know, here it is. And but they somehow couldn't get their heads around group assessment in that way.
And so when you each submitted your own drawings, did the marks then have to conform to the bell curve, some distinction?
Yeah. Some people who actually hadn't got up very early in the morning got very good marks because their drawings are excellent.
On the strength of their drawings.
Yes.
I can't even remember, actually.
Oh, mine was so tatty. I think I was doing them at 3 a.m. after I'd come back from waitressing all night.
I know. I thought that doing mine on yellow paper was going to get me a long way.
What was the benefit of yellow paper? It looked like proper architectural paper.
Mm.
Oh, it was just cool. Mm. So are there other things you'd like to say about the house and life and times around it?
I suppose we were just talking about Colin's influence on it. But at the same time, I think that he was probably as surprised as we were in what we actually did in the end. You know, it wasn't something that he had a clear idea of the way things were going to evolve. And he was, I mean, he continued to help us while we were living there in terms of making sure that the Buildings and Grounds Committee continued to give us approval.
That was the university committee.
That's right,
it?
And I actually became a member of the SRC, the Students' Representative Council, because traditionally the architecture faculty had supplied a student representative on the Buildings and Grounds Committee. And so that was seen as a way of being able to have a voice in what actually happened to the autonomous house. And as students, speaking personally, I was completely unaware of any of those sorts of things that meant whether something could be there or not be there. It was a whole new world to realise that there were people in other places who could make decisions about, you know, whether it was going to continue or not continue. I suppose, you know, that's how you change from being a sort of a naive young person to someone who understands a bit more about the way the world works.
Mm. Always useful.
Mm.
Jane, anything further?
I think I'm done.
Okay, thanks very much, both of you. Much appreciated.